You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Robert. Good to see you.
Good to see you. It's been too long. You've been raising your allegedly cute baby, and we'll return to that subject, by the way.
You know my baby's cute. I sent you pictures.
I know you think your baby's cute. I mean, I should just to foreshadow this later in the podcast, possibly in the overtime section, because this could get a little bitter. We're going to have a cute baby face off because I now have a granddaughter who is almost a month old, and Paul has a daughter who's, 3 months old, who Paul thinks is cuter than my granddaughter. And so ultimately, we'll let the viewers decide. But
to provide some background to the viewers, Paul Sammy is saying, my granddaughter is cuter than your daughter. At, you know, if you send me pictures at the age that they're at so you could calibrate. So send me, and then I am an adorable kid. I had an adorable kid. I sent pictures. And then I say to be nice, look, it's not a competition. He says, it's all a competition. It's status.
Status is a zero-sum game. And when it comes to babies, cuteness is the currency, you know?
It's they like don't with, have much, they with don't you have much and else. Me.
What?
They don't have much else. It's
no,
cuteness.
No, I mean, they power. Will. I will be comparing my grandchild's SAT scores eventually with your child's. We will do that podcast, but right now it's just all about cuteness. And going into the competition pretty confident. Okay.
We should be so lucky as to plan to be comparing these kids' SAT scores.
Especially in light of the uncertainty cast across our future by artificial intelligence. How is that for a segue, Paul? I should introduce this. You're the proprietor of the famous Small Potatoes newsletter and a world-renowned psychologist, man about town. Recently gave a TED talk, such as your stature, at the real TED conference, not some
real
TED.
The main stage.
Yeah, as they call it, TED. And I am Robert Wright. I was not asked to give a TED talk this year, but I'm not bitter. I'm totally over it. I really am. I rarely think about it anymore, Paul. Anyway.
Your TED talk was the one that you did give.
It was a classic.
It's
one for the ages.
Yep.
Oh my God, it was 19 years ago. It was the first year they put them online as videos. But anyway, what
you
else?
Look so young.
You're saying I don't look young now, Paul?
You still look young, but you look so young back then.
That's the way I would put it. And I put out the Non-Zero newsletter. This is a Non-Zero podcast. Anyway, Paul was kind enough to say, hey, Bob, since you've got this book coming out, in only a couple of weeks, called The God Test, about artificial intelligence, why don't we spend the whole podcast talking about your book? Now, I'm too modest to do that, but you went the extra mile and actually purport to have read the thing. And that, even if only half true, is a real commitment.
And, so my only criticism of the book, the big one, is you get the book, it's PDF, you send me the PDF yesterday, by the way.
Not sure you read the whole thing, by the way, but go ahead.
So I had kind of Clover Epitype in Bloom, and I'm in the acknowledgments in this huge name dump. I benefited from conversations from the following people. And there I am and everything. You know, I feel a more accurate description would be, I shape your worldview on this. I and beyond that, you wouldn't be in a shape to write a book at all if it wasn't for our conversations and my guidance for you. Just when you do the paperback, just amend.
Paul, a weird thing happened in the production process. And I don't know how this happened, but you know how it is being an author. You're not in control of everything. There had been the final paragraph, the acknowledgments began. And finally, I'd like to devote a paragraph to my spiritual advisor, Paul Bloom.
That's right. That's right.
I don't know. It's weird.
I kept reading. And then, you know, you talk about your wife. Very, very gracious. I said, okay, I'm next.
You wanted like above my wife?
I wanted your wife. And then you just did it in order of importance. Anyway, look, wonderful book. Wonderful book. I enjoyed it. I'm a fan of all your books. I haven't read Three Scientists and Their Gods, but I have read every other book you have written. I should read Three Scientists here just for completist purposes. I will say a few things. One thing, it is very nicely written. You write like you talk. You're sort of a pleasing, sarcastic aggressiveness to it. Nice humor. This is not something written by ChatGPT. You got to say this whenever you talk
that
about
it. That is true.
And the book works, as I see it, on three levels. So first, it is a very state-of-the-art description of where we stand with AI. And despite the fact that it's a book, and it takes time to go through things, it is, you know, you're talking about, you know, talk about things happening in 2025, and you talk about Molt book, you talk about, it is very current, it is very
2026, Molt, yeah, I even... I was like really antagonizing the production people at the last minute with insertions and galleys, but go ahead.
Second, as with all of your books, you spend a lot of time engaging in beefs and in settling old scores.
Oh, you know. Now we'll get to that. Okay, but anyway, false allegation. But go ahead.
Let me tell you what I think of it. Chinese.
Let me just say, I just had lunch with Steve Pinker, okay?
And who was one of the people
where you would say I'm like airing some kind of like beef with him, we parted on good terms. Of course, he hasn't read the chapter yet, but
anyway. No. If you read the chapter and what you had to say about him, you would not be having lunch.
I told him there was one paragraph he might not like, but it's very... It's fine. It's fine.
Right? It is fine. It is fine. There's another person who you can't even bear to say his name.
Well, his name.
You just allude to him. You allude to a blogger. You said, and then there's some blogger or like that who, you know. Can I say his name?
I refuse to confirm the name, but go ahead and say a name.
I think it is Jerry Coyne.
Oh, I've heard that name.
Yeah. Anyway.
That's all I can say.
A little bit of Dennett. A little bit of Dennett.
Well, Dennett, I mentioned in the appendix in a totally fair way. If he were alive, he would have no objection at all.
But anyway, and then third, and the biggest thing is the book is an argument. It is an argument for the real importance of AI. I got these quotes because I love them because of their. You describe what's happening now with LLMs as, you first say, the most abruptly dramatic transformation of human experience and human society in the history of our species. And then you're not like happy with that. To understand. So at the end, the next sentence, later you say, I think the coming of artificial intelligence marks a major threshold, not just in the species of our technology and not just in the species in the history of our species. Because you said species before, that's too, but in the history of our planet. So right. you make the case for it. You make the case. The word God shows up in many places. You talk about this as, I think, an extraordinary threat to us, an extraordinary opportunity, which could bring upon, you know, this wonderful paradise and also bring together, this challenge could bring together the people of the earth. But if we fail this challenge, we are toast. And, God, that's right. It's like the scene in the movie where somebody says, it's the perfect storm. And then for every podcast, you should say, it's the God test.
I like the way you whisper that. Yeah. And I just use that recording, that little snippet.
That's a clip it in. When you talk about it. And, you know, and we get into it. Book establishes themes that were developed mostly in Non-Zero. A lot of shoutbacks to Non-Zero. But also, to some extent in your Buddhism book, to some extent in the Evolution of God, themes about human progress, about the purpose of life, the purpose of evolution, about, you know, broader historical trends, challenges, and so on. Oh, books of delight. Okay, I ask you a question.
Okay. Should people pre-order now?
That's right. Should people pre-order? Should they buy? Should they put in their review in Amazon.com? Should they?
We're going to talk,
by the way, in the overtime segment about the mechanics.
About a book promotion these days, and I must say, rapidly changing landscape. Am I wrong? I mean, you're so prolific that it changes less rapidly for you. You write a book every like 3 years or something, but I
also with my level of fame, the promotion hardly matters.
No, I know. Your people call their people and you show up on like Joe Rogan or something.
That's right. That's right. Me and Joe. Okay. So a couple of questions. As a way to get you to introduce the theme of the book, so in these passages where you talk about the importance of superintelligence, you talk about awe, And you say one of the points of your book is to persuade people that they should feel awe about the coming of AI. And it occurs to me, it's a different way to slice this. Like you talk about doomers who think AI will kill us all, accelerationists who think that they're going to bring upon this post-scarcity utopia and we should hurry things up. But you cut things differently. And it occurs to me there's an interesting cut. There are those who experience awe when they think about AI. It is people like you. It is people like Yudkowsky, who thinks it's extraordinarily powerful, will kill us all. It is most of Silicon Valley, who the people who run Anthropic and OpenAI, just Sam Altman and so on. And then there are people who I would cleverly describe as nah, who are just saying, it's not going to kill us all. It's not going to save the world.
It's hype. Well, or moreover, the companies are hyping it. You see this a lot on the left, I would say.
That's right.
More than is good for the left. You're seeing this kind of thing that I think amounts to a kind of denialism that will in the end come back to haunt the left if it persists. But yeah.
Yeah. So I would include on the list, and I think these are all previous guests that you've spoken to, Gary Marcus, our friend Gary Marcus, Emily Bender.
Both mentioned along with you in the acknowledgments, by the way, and they're not complaining. Actually, Emily Bender's been known to complain about me, but never mind.
Yeah, she has this words for you. But Freddie DeBoer, who I've been reading a lot on AI, and is very, very...
I have to
very,
have him on the podcast, right?
You have to have him on the podcast. I would love to hear that.
That's a good idea.
You know, and he would go on and say, hey, here's a challenge for you. You know, spend a month without AI or spend a month without indoor plumbing. And as you're sort of shitting in your backyard, think about which is important. So he thinks it's just hype. And everything. Okay. So here's a way to frame this. There's a way to sort of get you talking about the book. What would you say to these very intelligent naysayers? What are they missing?
That is a question I very much want to answer. I want to quickly say that the word awe, like the doomers are feel it in a kind of archaic, but earlier, an earlier sense of the term, awe in the sense of terror. That was the overwhelming connotation of it, a couple hundred years ago. And then it was actually because of its religious usage to refer to the divine inspired terror that it was kind of in concert with the evolution of the conception of God, I think, that it came to have more positive connotations, all in the sense of sublime wonderful. Anyway, yeah, I go into that a little, but that's not the question you asked. Here's the thing, and this is what I've really tried to do in the book. One of the things that I most hope I succeed at is explaining to non-technical people from early on why this has got advanced so far, so fast. And I think if you don't acknowledge that it's been at least fairly rapid advance of capability, you're really not paying attention. But moreover, why we can be sure the advance is going to continue. And here I draw on what is the closest thing to a narrative framing of the book, which is that as it happens, in the 1980s, I interviewed the person now commonly referred to as the godfather of AI, Geoffrey Hinton. He's won not only the Turing Award for it, but the Nobel Prize for what he did because of its relevance to physics. And at the time I was writing about these two schools of thought, one, this maverick school involving neural networks that was kind of on the margins, and then the mainstream approach, which is kind of the Gary Marcus approach. As it happens, the maverick approach succeeded, and now Hinton is this god in the field. He himself is a doomer, though. He's terrified now, which he wasn't back when I talked to him. But anyway, the thing is, I now understand something that I didn't understand at the time. And I'm honestly not sure how clearly he understood the full potential of this fact I'm about to describe. But he was a lot closer than I was. I mean, we were nowhere near large language models back then. As I note in the book, he did write a paper in the mid-80s that kind of anticipated that. But even that was after I talked to him. And so anyway, here's the thing. Is, and maybe I should, I didn't set this up, but I think maybe I'll try to find this thing. A quote from from the 1956 Dartmouth Conference at which the term artificial intelligence was coined. Okay, the founding, you know, the founders of AI, John McCarthy, Marvin Minsky, and so on. I think maybe Claude Shannon, who did information theory, was there. Anyway, here's the quote from the proposal that led to this conference in the summer of 1956. They said, so, you know, artificial intelligence is taken to be, you know, making a machine behave in ways that would be called intelligent, if a human were so behaving. Here's the key passage that turned out to be deeply misleading so far as what would actually happen. Quote, the study is to proceed on the basis of the conjecture that every aspect of learning or any other feature of intelligence can in principle be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it. Okay, the key thing is it turned out with this neural network approach, what Hinton was calling, even when I talked to him in the 80s, massive parallelism, even though it wasn't massive yet, he was explaining that once we had a lot of cheap microprocessors, this would become very powerful. The key thing is with this, you do not have to, as they put it, precisely describe the dynamics of human cognition and instantiate them in the machine. The machine does the building of the cognitive mechanisms that perform the functions that the human mind performs. You just feed in a bunch of human data and train human generated data or human perceived data, like in the case of auto, you know, self-driving. You know, but anyway, you feed in input and output that you know, information like as it would be processed by a human brain, and you train the machine to predict how the human brain is going to respond. Most famously, just, you know, next word prediction, which is the first phase of training of a large language model, where here's the first part of the sentence, what would be a plausible next word. And it turns out that if you just teach a neural network to do that, it will build these mechanisms that we now understand do have a certain parallel with the mechanisms in the human mind. But we didn't have to understand anything about the human mind to get the machine to create these mechanisms.
Jump in and say, you're going on this, but to say that your book contains a really good discussion of how it's a mistake to dismiss this as autocomplete. Dismiss this as sort of, you know, makes it seem incredibly stupid, like what Google does when you type in a few words and you say, no, it's far more sophisticated than that. And actually, the mechanism that you're describing could lead to an output that's never been manifested in the input it received. So giving a sort of creativity. So anyway, I just want to say right. It's a pointer to the book to learn more about this.
And not only that, so yeah, I mean, the whole stochastic parrot thing, I mean, I'm sorry, that's just such a deeply misleading metaphor to begin with. Parrots don't process the meaning of the words they repeat. And we now know, and this is a good example of the machine kind of inventing something significant, like it has a system for representing the meaning of the words, and we now know what that is. I don't want to give it complete credit for that because we did say to the machine, look, you got to represent each word, well, strictly speaking, each token, as a long sequence of numbers separated by commas, that is to say, a vector. Still, we didn't say and figure out a way that this sequence of numbers will reflect the meaning of the word. But we now understand how the machine actually does wind up breaking words down into the kind of the components of their meaning and representing those with numbers. I won't go into that further, but it's for that reason that, and this is, I think, a key point, still, I think, not totally appreciated, or not everyone in the field would agree with this characterization. Many would, but even they don't articulate it almost ever, and I don't think people understand it, which is that the training of a large language model is like, yes, it is in some ways a process of learning, but in important ways, it is like a process of evolution. It is like It is like collapsing all of human, like natural selection, into a few months, at least in the sense that it really does come up with specific mechanisms, cognitive mechanisms and perceptual mechanisms that, in the case of vision training, image recognition, that it took evolution much, much longer to come up with. And evolution like built them into us. Natural selection built them into our genes. So it's not just, you know, the old phrase, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. What that mean? You know, ontogeny, unfolding of an organism, recapitulates evolution. It's a disputed claim, but the point is, you know, it begins with the acknowledgement that if you view embryonic development, right, like of a child, they start out looking kind of like reptiles, and they look more like, you know, and it almost looks like sequence of stages of evolution. Well, leave all that aside. My point is that the training of a large language model is like both phylogeny and ontogeny at the same time. I don't mean that it reverse engineers exactly the mechanisms in the human brain, but I do think, and again, some people in the field might argue with this, but I think not that many, honestly, I do think it reverse engineers mechanisms that are functionally comparable to the mechanisms in the human brain that evolution engineered in. And this is why we know it's going to get super powerful, because in any realm at all, driving a car, doing the dishes, whatever, it is possible, and we haven't done it yet in a lot of cases, or the job you're doing now, the reason Mark Zuckerberg is now monitoring the keystrokes of his employees is he's doing this with them so that he can replicate the thought process they use to do their job, and then he can fire them, okay? Because you can take any data set in any perceptual realm, you know, speech, audio, written, vision, sound, smell, any. And once you've got the data, you can get these things to kind of reverse engineer functionality comparable to our own functionality. That's good. My claim.
And so you kind of answered in two ways. So first, you sort of describe AI. Isn't it like, shouldn't you feel awed at this intellectual accomplishment that Jeff Hinton and other people came up with? Like, isn't that like an amazing accomplishment? I get that. And then you move to more as a sort of meat of the concern, which is, yeah, but what difference does it make? Like, you know, right now, I use chat and Claude for a lot of things. It's very useful. But I also use a washing machine. Honestly, the washing machine is more important. Mm-hmm. If I didn't have a washing machine, I have to wash my clothes by hand, and it'd take hours and hours and hours. I'd rather have to go back to Google and I'd rather give up chat than give up my washing machine. But you're saying that, yeah, but what's happening is there's a process that's going to get better and better and better and better. Mm-hmm. It's sort of an argument I've actually heard from Sam Harris, he has a sort of AI doomer talk once. And he says, why do we think, imagine you could put things on a single scale of intelligence. You know, it's. I think you'd miss it as wrong, but imagine you can, simple as that. Like, so you get a machine that's 80 IQ, 90 IQ. Why do you think it's going to stop at where humans are? Why do you think that it's sort of a limit to us? So the idea that I think, you tell me if I'm wrong, is that right now these machines are impressive in many ways, unimpressive in others. But the direction that they're going is they're just going to get better and better than us and maybe become as if they are gods.
Right. And, you know, now you might say, well, they can only become as smart as us, not smarter. But first of all, we're already seeing exceptions. I mean, it was only like last week, there was a big hubbub about, GPT, latest GPT model, solving, you know, proving one of these great unsolved math problems. And, you know, you're seeing stuff like that. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Like, first of all, yeah, it's, you know, it's true that in terms of training data, it would seem that in some respects, the ceiling on the data is just what people can do, right? But on the other hand, you know, given a single AI can be completely capacious in the extent of its knowledge, it can be not just like the world's leading expert in one thing, but everything. Also, it works a lot faster. And finally, keep in mind, these things can collaborate intellectually the way people can. We've already established that. And that is, you know, most of the actual progress in you know that, having looked at this, having looked into how various ideas took shape, you know, there's often one person who gets credit for it, but you look back and it's like, as Isaac Newton said, I stand on the shoulders of giants. It's always a collaborative process, whether intergenerationally or intragenerationally, that leads to the great ideas. And now you're going to have, I'm not saying you have this quite yet, but you're going to have this happening at a very fast pace, this kind of intellectual synergy. I think now people might say, wait a second, you know, maybe we won't have any more breakthroughs on par with like the transformer or multimodal training or chain of thought reasoning, which are kind of the last big three, I would say. I mean, I think even if you didn't, we'd go a very long ways, but also you probably will. I mean, they keep figuring stuff out.
So we've talked before where I sort of relayed Freddie DeBoer's challenge, which he made to Scott Alexander. So he is very much of a, this is nothing burger. This is just, you know, bullshit and hype. And his challenge was to Scott Alexander saying, look, you say it's going to transform the world, so let's put some money on it. Let's make specific predictions about the stock market and the job rate and so on. And when I raised that to you, your answer, which I found pretty persuasive, is you think it will have most likely a huge change, but you can't predict the directionality of it. So it's kind of a wash. If you were confident it would make GDP magnify by a factor of 100, that's one thing. If you were confident it would drive the economy to dust, that's another thing. But since you don't know which one it is, you mm-hmm. can't make money off of it.
There's the timing issue too. There's a line from The Big Short, I think, where somebody says, "I wasn't wrong. I was just early." And the guy says, "Early is wrong."
You know? That was
like he shorted the market too soon.
What? This guy, I forget his name. He was played by handsome guy actor, and he basically predicted the housing market would crash, but he had to keep waiting. And his investors were freaking out and abandoning him. He had to keep waiting for it to happen. And you can imagine a lot of that, both the doomers and the accelerationists in a sort of waiting pattern. But let me ask you this, just to get a feeling for what we're talking about. Right now, what we're doing is 2026. I'm sitting here, you know, I'm going to take my daughter out for a walk to the park soon. I have a job. I have, you know, this is life. And it's not that different from 2016. Mm-hmm. In between, there was a pandemic. That's just a glip, and only that. The world is different in many ways, but, you know, we have phones now, it's staring in front of a screen. Do you think that 10 years from now, it'll still be life is kind of pretty much the same? Or do you think it'll be radically different? That we won't, whatever we're doing now, spending our time for pleasure, for work, for relationships, for sex, we won't be doing that. We'll be in pods off to Alpha Centauri, or we'll be slaves of AI, or we'll be dead, or we'll be in the same, you know, we'll be in a, do you think things will be very different 10 years from now?
I do. I'm not sure Alpha Centauri is where the pods will be, but no, I'm not sure there will be pods, but I think, yes, I will say first, people are adaptable in a couple of senses. First of all, they find a way to get by even after change, and B, they kind of forget how things used to be, so that they almost underestimate how different the world was. It's like you notice this sometimes with movies that may be only 20 years old, but you go, oh, this whole plot couldn't happen now.
Yeah.
Like they'd be able to, you know, they'd have Google Maps.
There was a Seinfeld Chinese restaurant thing, which if they had cell phones would have been immediately resolved, because they didn't.
Oh, there's tons of these. Will the world be more dramatically different than has ever been the case after 10 years? I would say not only yes, but by a long shot. That's my prediction, yes.
That's a great prediction. So if 10 years from now, I'm sitting here, and you're sitting there, and we're just talking and everything like that, that is not what you would expect. That's a falsification of the claim. But if instead we're, you know, a difference we can't even imagine, because yeah. That's what radical change looks like.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you took somebody from, I don't know, 1926 And then you said, predict the crazy future. They may say all sorts of things. It'd be like jetpacks and so on, but they wouldn't say, and men and women, men could marry men and women could marry women. And mm-hmm. everybody would be fine with that. They wouldn't say it because they couldn't imagine what that difference would be.
Right. That's actually a good example. So I was at the New Republic when Andrew Sullivan wrote his cover story for the New Republic, which was a huge intellectual event about gay marriage, the case for gay marriage. Yep. And I was like, what are you talking about? I just hadn't heard anybody bring the subject yeah. up. And that's, so that's a good example.
I'm old enough that as a philosophical example of something that's true by definition, a man cannot have a baby. It's just an example of something which is a simple fact that's true by definition. Now you get in a lot of trouble in sort of social media sites for saying that a man cannot have a baby because they would say a trans man can have a baby. And well, it's just, plus, you wouldn't have predicted it.
Yeah. No, this is all true. Well, look, that's why, I mean, if you read my book, I leave the future open to a very broad range of possibilities, ranging from heaven to hell to something in between. Actually, there's something worse than hell, which is maybe worse. I don't know, actually, but human extinction. I think that's a real possibility. I'm not predicting it the way Yudkowsky does, but I do like march through the logic of the Yudkowskys, and I like to think in a way I go further, because they when they talk among themselves, they just make these sweeping declarations, and even when they write books, it doesn't get all that much further than that. And I try to make it a little more fine grained. Yeah. And just the point is, it's actually very hard to dismiss at least the possibility that things could get out of control in the way they worry about.
Now, one of the very nice sections of your book, you point out Yudkowsky has, famously strong views of it being the author of the book, co-author of the book, If Anybody Builds It, We'll All Die. That's what the title is. And you point out he is not a particularly effective communicator of this. And I've heard him being interviewed, and he has this impatience with people who don't quickly get his point, and his examples are not accessible and so on. And so what you try to do, I think, and I see an evolution of your own views here, which I think you were once a lot more skeptical about the Yudkowsky line. But I think you said, well, let me make this plausible, and let me give you express this in a way that's more understandable and more convincing.
Yeah. And if you want to see how far I've come and even how far he's come, on YouTube, there's a conversation I had with him 15 years ago, and he was not yet a full-on doomer, and I was very skeptical of his claims.
He started off as an accelerationist, I think.
Yeah. No, he got his original money from Peter Thiel. The singularity was going to be wonderful. Something I never understood. It's like, if it's the singularity, like if stuff starts changing so fast. I mean, the term singularity, its use in physics refers to a situation where you have no idea what goes on beyond a certain point. Beyond the event horizon, the laws you're familiar with break down and you don't know what's going to happen. And the first use of singularity in this context by John von Neumann made explicit kind of reference to that idea of the laws of human affairs breaking down. And so I was always like, what? Why? Are you optimistic? Unless you're like religious, unless it's like a religious faith, and they say they're not. They say they're the opposite of that. And so I never got that. But anyway, Eliezer, to his credit, changed his views early and has proved prescient in predicting that these machines would have certain kinds of worrisome tendencies, which it turns out they have, toward deception, toward power seeking, toward, and so on, toward self-preservation, like resisting, like resorting to extreme measures to keep from getting shut down. Now, these are in laboratory. These are in experiments. Mostly, these are in experimental conditions. And people say, well, the conditions are too contrived. I don't know. I think it's pretty clear that we should not be sanguine about this.
Yeah, I mean, the skeptical response to some of these demonstrations is nicely captured in this cartoon I've seen a few times, where the first panel is somebody going up to like a computer and say, hey, say I'm conscious. And the second panel is the computer goes, I'm conscious. And the person goes, oh my God. And so to some extent, a lot of the behavior of these things, for instance, the Microsoft machine that was interviewed by Kevin Roos a few years back and then claimed to fall in love with him and demanded he leave his wife, and that his love for his wife was not sincere. He really loves her. But to some extent, it plays this crazy science fiction insane machine, which it had been exposed to. And so a lot of the discourse, I think the cleverest studies often involve those that go into the guts of the machine and say,
oh yeah,
explore systems, how it's exerting self-control, what it really believes in some sense.
Fascinating. Some of the things they're finding, but it's important to remember that there's still a lot they don't know. I mean, to some extent, these are black boxes, and that's worth pondering. And now I take your point. First of all, I think it was the code name for that particular model of the AI
Sydney.
Was Sydney for Sydney. Some reason, and Microsoft had put it out in connection with Bing, I guess. But anyway, look, first of all, yeah, it's kind of a common vein of thinking about what's happening in some of these situations is that basically the model gets in a particular narrative groove. Like, it's been trained on text where there are these certain kinds of people. Like, they'll try to steal you from your wife, which they did in this case. And we should say he worked long and hard, you know, with his prompts to steer into one of these weird grooves.
Yeah.
That said, you know, there's going to be a lot of people using these things, and not only that, but remember that, with open source AIs, people can fine tune the models, actually change their weights, change their character in various directions. And so there's just, my main point is we have no idea what's going to happen. There's such a range of possibilities. If you're ruling out the catastrophic ones, I really don't think you're paying attention. And we need to get together and think about this. And we have to do that as a global community.
So that brings us back to Peter Thiel. So you're discussing Peter Thiel's views on all of this. And at one point, he talks a lot about the Antichrist. And at one point, you say, I think correctly, that when he thinks about the Antichrist, he might well be thinking about you. Maybe not you in particular, but
I know he's not aware of me. I say he's thinking about people like me.
You represent, in his view, you represent the views of the Antichrist.
Yeah.
I like that passage. I'll answer my own question, which is, this is because you see world government as a viable, as a response to the AI potential threat. And you came at this, I'm not sure you came at this fully honestly, because that's something you had always wanted anyway. And this is in some way how this God test builds up from the themes of your earlier books, which is your argument is that you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but one part of it is there's a general trend towards increasing consolidation and cooperation. But the second thing is, just on a practical level, to solve serious threats, we need to form a world government of some sort. And that AI counts as a serious threat. So here's yet another argument for the outcome you want, an outcome that Thiel, I think, literally views as the plan of the Antichrist.
No, he does equate world government. I think even the term global governance with the Antichrist. Now, I don't use the term world government in terms of what I'm advocating. Partly because... And this is really important. And by the way, there's a little news flash. We might as well get slightly topical. The Trump administration has actually issued this delayed and subsequently amended executive order that will, as a practical matter, mean that the federal government reviews the most powerful large language models produced by American companies. Strictly speaking, it's voluntary, but the big makers are not going to try to defy it, I think.
Yeah.
And what it points to, I mean, this is the dilemma we face, and I'll get back to, and this is why I use the term global governance, not world government, is because on the one hand, we do need some kind of systematized institutional oversight of these things, or things will get out of control. I'll elaborate on that. On the other hand, it's you know, leaving aside whether the institutions are governmental, they may not be, and maybe that's better. But the on the other hand, there is real danger in a concentration of power in the control of these things. And the Trump administration so perfectly illustrates that. Like right now, it has Mythos. We don't. If ever there was an administration I would not trust to use it responsibly, like, that's it. And you know, so Mythos gives it the power to, I mean, of course, the government has a lot of technical surveillance power it's not supposed to use anyway, but Mythos could give it whole new ways to do surveillance without being detected and to break into systems and so on. And it's like, do you trust the Trump administration? Now, I don't. On the other hand, even so, I got to admit, we need something like this. And so that is the fundamental dilemma with AI. Too much control, centralized control is dangerous. Too little oversight is dangerous. And both could lead to catastrophes, like a global police state at one end and utter chaos, collapse, extinction at the other. So now, as for when you said, well, I wanted world government to begin with. Well, again, I always use the term global governance because it shouldn't be too, it should be as decentralized as possible. But I would say I would object to quite the way you phrased it, because it's the same argument I've always made. AI is a manifestation of a technological trend that was all along the basis for my arguing for more international governance. Perfect example is bioweapons. You can go back and find me, like in the 1990s, in the New Republic, in a cover story called Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid. That was Andrew Sullivan's phrase. Very good. He came up with the title. About weapons of mass destruction. Like pointing out that, like, a truly contagious bioweapon, it, you know, you can't control that at the national level. You need international governance. And so the argument I've been making all along is that various technologies, information technologies, weapons technology, all kinds of technologies make relations among nations more non-zero sum, in that they give the nations an interest in a common self-interest in cooperating to govern these things. And AI is just much, much, much more of that pretty suddenly. And bioweapons is perfect because one thing AI can do is help people make bioweapons. So it exacerbates that challenge. And B, a lot of the other things AI can do, like Mythos hopping from, you know, data center to data center and taking over the world or whatever, which, of course, it can't do. But it suggests that, you know, rogue AIs like that could be problematic. You know, that's kind of a. Biological weapons is a good metaphor for that, right? So so the bioweapons thing is a good way to frame the perils posed by AI. And there are many more. I mean, surveillance, again, and surveillance is the reason you want to be careful about how much regulation you introduce to address the other problems. But yeah, Peter Thiel is among those who are allergic to the idea of apparently just about any international governance. He doesn't like the World Trade Organization. He doesn't, you know. And yeah, it's true.
You sound very reasonable, just like the Antichrist probably would be on his quest for world government. I guess I would just make a distinction between the normative and the descriptive. I mean, you're providing a really good case for why it's a perfectly rational response for the countries of the world to get together to deal with the AI threat. And it's something that Yudkowsky's been pushing for a lot, and it makes a lot of sense. As a matter of fact, and I'm not sure you'll disagree with this, at least in the United States, the narrative has almost been the opposite, which is that the development of AI has led to sort of a exaggerated and xenophobic reaction to China, which is we must beat the Chinese so they don't get there first. Somebody's going to have this. It better be us and not them. And so it's been moving in the opposite direction than the direction, which I think you plausibly enough say it should go in.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think the race dynamic is the last thing we need. And in fact, you know, because as I said, this stuff is just already moving faster than I think we're going to be able to wisely respond to, right? We're And remember, our government is in a shambles in terms of its ability to respond wisely to anything. It's almost dysfunctional, right? Because the polarization is so extreme, which is one reason I, you know, toward the end of the book, I talk about the psychology of tribalism, because we can't afford the domestic polarization, let alone the international conflict in I think, the coming age. We're going to have to get together and think about this calmly. But the
I am sufficiently anti-Trump, sufficiently disgusted and disdained by what him and his council is doing, that I prefer dysfunctional. I prefer blocked by partisanship, messy and everything, as opposed to an efficient, well-running system where he gets a lot of power to do what he wants.
In a way, what I'm saying is AI is going to render that position untenable. In other words, right now, yeah, a completely dysfunctional government beats a government in which he would be able to do everything he wants to do. But I'm just saying, in the age of AI, either of those two extremes is going to be hell. Okay, like some crazy guy centralizing power, because the if he really secures control of the technology of AI, lights out, kind of. I mean, in one sense or another, either oppressive authoritarianism or worse. But at the other end, I'm just telling you, if we have no governance of this technology, I could be wrong, but I mean, at a minimum, you're going to have some sort of organic emergence of normative solutions through the magic of the free market in synergy with the wisdom of human beings or something, maybe. But, and like I said, non-governmental, there is such thing as de facto non-governmental regulation in a way. And I mean, I guess if it's regulation, it's kind of governmental, but there are ways to try to have it both ways, but it's going to be it's going to be like threading the needle.
Yeah. Let me step back to like ask a different aspect of the big question in your book, and maybe the only thing which I didn't fully see where you were going with, and you could clarify things with me, which is there's a couple of big ideas in your book, and I didn't know how to make them go together. So one is the idea of that there are forces driving us to become increasingly interconnected as individuals. Yeah. This is something you did in the legendary TED Talk a while ago.
Legendary.
You have this nice quote from Orwell's 1984, where somebody says, I guess it's Smith. He says, can you not understand, Winston, that the individual is only a cell? The weariness of the cell is the vigor of the organism. I get that, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, that's the totalitarian talking to Winston Smith, I think. Yeah.
So the idea is there's this growth. And then there's the idea of AI itself being a super intelligent that grows, communicates with other AI, and so on. I didn't know how to connect the two ideas, like, because in the original idea, we are parts of this broader system. And I can see that being working for, say, social media. Uh-huh. But I'm not part of ChatGPT, and ChatGPT isn't part of me. Is it the idea there's two independent systems growing and spreading, or are we interconnected somehow?
I think maybe, should that be the cliffhanger that gets people to cross the paywall, Paul?
If that won't get people to cross, nothing will.
And become paid subscribers either to Small Potatoes or to Non-Zero. And by the way, you know, through the magic of the Non-Zero Network, paid subscribers to either can get a 50% discount on a one-year subscription to the other. I know there's a way to find that on our website, and you can just put in a link. You very kindly always send out a post when we do one of these, and you can just put a link to the network page on that, so your subscribers can do the same. In any event, you know, paid subscribers either can watch or listen to the rest of this, and There's a link in our show notes and in Paul's version of this. And and of course we're gonna have the cute baby face off.
And we're gonna talk to, I had this this Substack out called Moneyball for publishers and Substack writers, where I explored the mechanics of how do you promote your book. And I come off very skeptical. I say there is no secret sauce. There is just no secret sauce. And I talk a bit about that. So I wanted to use you as a case study. You are about to promote a book. How could we do this? Or is there no answer?
Well, one of the keys is you say to people right before your paywall, even if you don't follow us into the paywall, hey, give me a break. Do me a favor. Pre-order on Amazon. That's one thing.
That is something you could try. That is something. Yes.
I would not do that because, crass self-promotion is something that just I'm allergic to. So I would not say something like, please, 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 please pre-order my book. Like right before the paywall, like, okay, fine. You're not a paid subscriber. Could you at least pre-order my book? I would never say something like that.
Too much dignity, I think.
I exude it, right? You can smell the dignity.
Yeah.
So anyway, subtitle is, if the God test didn't do it, artificial intelligence and our coming cosmic reckoning. I mean, is that going too far, Paul? Wait, answers after the paywall. Paul may, we may see a little flip here where Paul goes rogue on me. And as they say in Pulp Fiction, I'm gonna get medieval with your ass now, or whatever it is. What's the line? I'm gonna go medieval.
I think that's kind of line. It's an unfortunate way to end this otherwise amicable conversation.
I'm not promising it. That's the suspense. Will Paul go medieval? We don't know. It's a mystery. Okay, but thanks everybody who's followed us this far. And Paul, thank you for suggesting this. Did I point out that you suggested this exercise in crass self-promotion on my part?
I really enjoyed the book.
You've been so nice. You really have. You brought out the things that I want to bring out. You're saving the fierce and painful criticism for after the paywall. Exactly what I would have asked you to do.
Glad.
That's the kind of guy you are. And you know, by the way, everyone says you're a nice guy. Do you know that?
No.
Everyone. It's kind of annoying, frankly. Because I'm not sure everyone says that about me. Do they?
Let's discuss that in the paywall.
Okay. All right. Thanks, folks. Here comes overtime.